G'day everyone, welcome back to another week on The Birder's Guide. How's your self-isolation birding been going? I have been birding exactly nowhere, except our driveway and a few road stops between home and town. Luckily for me, I guess, we live in the middle of a paddock and about 15 kilometres of dirt roads between here and anywhere. So my yard list, so to speak, consists of about a kilometre of driveway. Well, it's about 300 metres of driveway and then 700 metres of summer track, dry weather road. But no one uses it, so I just call it my driveway. So my yard list currently stands at 55 species, which is pretty good for around here, I think. Nothing majorly rare or vagranty, but I do have an owl at night jar which makes an appearance two or three times a year and then just disappears, which is pretty impressive really when all the trees are around 6 feet of the road and then just empty paddocks in every direction. And I have walked that tree line at night countless times and I've never seen him or her, which is pretty decent effort on their behalf really. I've got a decent number of raptors on our yard list. Brown falcon, black falcon, wedge-tailed eagle, spotted harrier, black-shouldered kite, and Nankeen kestrel. I figured I was going to be doing this introduction to this podcast, so yesterday I did a quick hour-long walk to see what was around. Managed to find a very impressive 4 species: house sparrow, willy wagtail, brown falcon, and Nankeen kestrel, which was actually a first for my yard list, and so species number 55, so that was interesting. I think I'd probably average maybe 10, 12 species on a normal outing, which isn't too bad for around here. Anyway, enough of that. Hope you guys have had slightly better isolated birding outcomes, so let's get into today's conversation.
You're listening to The Birder's Guide with Michael Greenshields.
So today on the show, we've got Will Mitchell. So last year, Will won one of BirdLife's... He won, W-O-N, one, O-N-E. He won one of BirdLife Australia's research awards for his project looking at relocating Mallee emu wrens into Narkat Conservation Park. And I was quite interested to see what he came up with. All right, Will, welcome to The Birder's Guide. Great to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Michael.
So you're currently doing your PhD. Before we get into that, I was just curious as to whether you were a birder before you started on your path to PhDism, or if birding was something you sort of fell into during your study, whether... I assume you didn't go straight from high school to doing a PhD, but somewhere in the middle there?
yeah. So I guess I've always been interested in nature and the outdoors. I probably, like a lot of people, through the sort of high school years, or maybe not so much. Other stuff sort of takes your attention during those years. But yeah, I wouldn't call myself a birder until, yeah, I guess sort of after my undergraduate degree, and then when I sort of started pursuing research or something maybe I wanted to do a bit more seriously is when I sort of started getting into it. Initially, my partner was actually a bit more into it than me. She was studying outdoor education, and they do quite a bit of sort of they spend a lot of time out in the bush and just, you know, observing animals and plants and things. And she kind of helped me find my feet a little bit when I first started getting interested. And then I guess I've gone down the road of the birder since then a bit more than her, and caught the fever a little bit. And so I guess over the last 3 or 4 years, I've gotten a bit more into it.
And what was your undergrad?
I sort of changed course. I mean, I did a science degree, a general science degree. I sort of entered that with the idea that maybe I'd do sort of a physics or engineering major. I realized pretty quickly that maths gets quite a bit harder than I anticipated, and fortunately was really enjoying my biology breadth subjects. So I switched over into an ecology major, and I'm glad I did because, I think it's much more appropriate for me than what I was doing.
I saw last year that you were awarded the Professor Alan Keast Research Award. Can you just give us an overview of what that award is and perhaps what it helps you achieve as a student?
Yeah, absolutely. So BirdLife have a bunch of sort of student research awards that they offer, the Stuart Leslie Research Award and the Alan Keast Research Award and a couple of others that I've forgotten the name of. So I think in my case, that money, and I guess I should also just add that I'm extremely thankful to BirdLife for helping me out in that way. And I'm sure other students in the same situation would say the same thing. But in my case, I think, I don't know, I feel like maybe I'm getting a bit ahead of myself. My research is mainly focused on the translocation of Mallee Emu Wren. And sort of we'll probably talk about that a bit more later, but one of the outcomes of that project was that we ended up having, genetic material from all of the birds that we translocated. They were all sourced in sort of the main areas where that bird's still found in Hatter Colchine and Murray Sunset in Victoria. So we're interested in doing some genetic analyses, but there is a very small population and spatially isolated population in our Weipperfeld National Park. So part of that money from BirdLife just allowed me to do some monitoring of at some of the translocation sites, but it also helped me get into Weipperfeld and try and catch some Mallee Emu Wren in there to try and get some DNA.
Why did you choose Mallee Emu Wrens? I personally quite like Mallee Emu Wrens. The logo of the Birders Guide is a Mallee Emu Wren.
Yeah, I saw that.
Why did you choose them in particular as your project?
Good question. So my honours, which I guess was my first foray into research on birds, was looking at thermal cameras and seeing if we can sort of use that as a tool to learn a little bit more about roosting behaviour of birds. And I did that field work in the area I grew up in, sort of Christmas Hills and Warrandyte in the northeast of Melbourne. That was heaps of fun. When I sort of decided to do a PhD, partially selfishly, one of the criteria I was looking for in a project was that I'd get to go somewhere adventurous and at least to my mind, I guess exotic in some way. And that was one of the things that drew me. The Mallee Emu Wren are obviously found in the Mallee, and the Mallee is this just beautiful, beautiful part of the world to get to work. They're also a really charismatic bird. I'm sure they're familiar to most birders who are probably your target audience, but they're very cute. The way they, jump up on a triode or hummock and they have so much attitude for not quite the smallest bird in Australia, but pretty close. I guess there's some reasons.
Yeah, for sure. So the program that you, I don't know whether oversaw is the right word, but the program that you did your PhD on, was that already one that was up and running, or did you pioneer the whole, let's try and reintroduce some Mallee Emu Wrens to another area and see what happens?
I definitely didn't pioneer it. There was some hardworking, awesome people who had been sort of thinking along those lines for a long time and doing a lot of really important kind of background work leading up to a project like that. I kind of jumped in at the, when all the action started happening, probably 2 or 3 months before the first translocation happened. So I've kind of had to hit the ground running a little bit. So I guess people both from DEW there's so many people. Some people from La Trobe Uni, Monash Uni, the Victorian and South Australian Environment Departments from the government, and zoos in South Australia. Yeah, so it's been a a lot of work from a lot of people, and I was lucky enough to sort of get taken under their wings, to use a probably cheesy bird pun. And yeah, very thankful to all those people for helping me, and hopefully I've been of some of some use as well in the project.
So you say you came in and were involved in the project. Were you part of the actual physical relocation of the birds, or are you were you just more the assessment of it?
Yeah, so I was I sort of helped out with all of that. I guess the first sort of on-ground stuff that I was involved in was just helping to scope out some of the potential source sites, the with sort of the main field officers, guys Luke and Tom and another guy Simon. So we went out and sort of did some surveys to sort of find where the densest areas were, due to some work by Simon Verdon in his PhD. He's a La Trobe student. He'd sort of already earmarked some likely sites, and so we were basically just going to have a bit of a look. He'd done some population modelling that allowed us to be pretty have a pretty good idea of where the densest Meleimuran areas were. So yeah, and then I spent a couple of days helping catching birds, and then I spent most of the translocations out in Narkat, kind of keeping tabs on the birds after release. So we sort of did pretty intensive monitoring for until around 2 weeks after the last release. I think the average weight we had was around 5 grams, somewhere between 3.5 and 6 grams is sort of the normal Meleimuran. So it's pretty hard to get a tracker on them. And in addition to that, for an endangered species, we're erring on the side of caution as well, because they move so quickly through the sort of dense tangle of spines that make up a Spinifex. We're pretty concerned that trackers would be, like radio telemetry trackers could potentially cause them issues. So all of that monitoring that we were doing in Narkat was all just sort of the old-fashioned way, I guess, using a bit of call playback, but mainly just walking through the Triodia in the area and trying to find them.
Yeah, because I saw that, talking about trying to keep track of them, I saw that one of your questions, your research questions, was around the use of, and I'm going to find it here so I say it right, autonomous acoustic recorders. So what is that? Did you have any sort of outcome to that question, or is that still in the process?
Yeah, that's sort of still ongoing. So acoustic recorders are, autonomous. It just means it turns itself on and off. But basically you can get these recorders that you can stick out in the bush. They've been around for quite a long time, but in the last few years they've been getting quite a bit cheaper. So I guess
Are these just what people would know as trail cams, or are they specific for bird calls?
So they're not really filming. They're mainly just recording audio. So as opposed to like a camera trap or something. They're mainly used for birds and bats, although you could use them to kind of track any vocal species. People have used them in other parts of the world for trying to record things like gunshots for areas where poaching is an issue. They've been getting cheaper, and the software that allows you to sort of automatically detect calls is getting it's still a bit of work getting the software side to do what you want, but we're getting closer with that kind of technology. So yeah, we were sort of interested to see whether they'd be useful for monitoring Meleimuran. Again, I'm hesitant to talk too much about like what Meleimuran, you know, I just figure most of your audience are super familiar with them, because a lot of people get out to the Mallee, a lot of birders get out to the Mallee to have a look at them. But yeah, they've, especially during the months leading up to the breeding season, they're quite vocal. Even though they're a tiny bird, you can kind of hear them from, I don't know, 50 to 100 meters away on a good day, like a really still day, and if they're really singing their hearts out. Yeah, I guess we're interested to see whether these audio recorders could be an effective tool to monitor them. The idea is...
Do you have any
I was just going to say, the idea is because you can set up a whole bunch of them, you know, like maybe 50 across an area, you can sort of cover a whole area simultaneously, whereas one observer might take quite a lot of time to cover all that ground.
Do you have any idea of whether that's going to be successful?
Not as of yet. So I put out about 40 of them last year in a paired study where we had 40 of these at sort of monitoring points, and then we also had people going and visiting the same monitoring points over about a week to sort of see how effective they were compared to actual normal human observers. Unfortunately, we detected only like 3 birds on that particular survey, so we don't really have the sample size to actually make any meaningful comparison. The plan is to try that experiment again. It would have been to try it again around now, but we've sort of all been grounded a little bit due to the current global pandemic situation. So the plan now is to go out in, obviously health crisis pending, the plan now is to go out in spring this year and have another crack at some kind of denser sites where emu wrens are a little bit thicker on the ground. And hopefully we'll be able to, see how well it works. It is also a little bit dependent on, I still need to put a little bit more work into the kind of recognition software. So at the moment, the computer can recognize a Mallee emu wren call, but it is also, it sometimes gets a bit confused with things like fairy wrens and other things that get picked up in the recording. So it's quite a process to get it fine-tuned, where you're kind of maximizing detections but minimizing those false detections.
Yeah. And I suppose that would be a fair bit of work because you've got emu wrens, fairy wrens, grass wrens, all of which at a basic level sound fairly similar. So being able to separate them is a task, I assume.
Yeah, absolutely. It's proving difficult.
If we can double back to something we were talking about before.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, how do you choose the specific birds that you're going to relocate? Are you finding a family group that's big enough to split in half, or are you taking a whole family group where there's 3 or 4 nearby?
Yeah, great question. So in our case, we weren't even sure that we were going to be able to catch them in with the efficiency to translocate them. So we were really just, especially early on, we were just seeing what we could get. But the goal ultimately was to translocate kind of intact social groups where we could. So we found a family group, would try and catch all of them and move them together. We did release some unfamiliar groups sort of as an experiment to see if that had an effect on survival. The aim, I suppose, would be to catch an intact social group.
Mm. And once you've chosen the birds and once you've caught them, how do you choose where they go? Are you looking for areas that already have family groups so you know they can survive there, or are you looking for new areas? Because Narkat doesn't have a massive population of Mallee emu wrens in it.
Yeah, well, I think Narkat, at the time that we were releasing them, they hadn't had any detections in Narkat for 4 or 5 years, I think. I think they were considered extinct in South Australia at that point. Largely due to a series of fires through that region. A lot of Narkat burnt in 2006. There was a small population that sort of persisted right on the southern border and across into some private land. But they as well sort of dropped off due to just a bit of habitat degradation and also fire in 2014. The goal became to try and release them back into the areas that had the first of all, that pre-fire had the greatest kind of abundance of Malleimmurans, and then secondly, the areas that had the highest density sort of triodia or spinifex.
So talking about the effectiveness, or I don't know what the antonym of effectiveness is, but uneffectiveness of a relocation.
Yeah.
What's the criteria for a successful relocation?
That's an interesting question. Ultimately, the success criteria is whether you can establish a population that will persist in the long term under its own steam, basically. When you dig through the scientific literature on translocations, there are sort of varied definitions of a success. I guess sometimes the success is just, sometimes the people are just trying to see, I guess they're proofing the idea, they're just trying to see whether the animals can live in that, in a certain habitat, or whether, you know, they survive X amount of generations or something like that. But I think especially these days, people are agreeing that ultimately what you want is a population that can persist on its own without kind of human intervention.
So talking about multiple generations, have you had any idea of whether there's any breeding happening in the populations that were relocated?
I guess this gets us to sort of the story of the Emurans in Narkat. So we released them in 2018. We released a cohort in April and then another cohort in August. Especially those birds that were released in August, which is kind of right in the lead up to the breeding season, they sort of started. We don't actually know a whole lot about sort of Malleimmuran breeding behavior and stuff like that, but we started seeing behavior that I guess was indicative of the birds getting ready to breed. Like we saw some display behavior, just literally like in the weeks after the translocation. So that was in August, September. We went back in October and I think we found 7 groups that had either nestlings or fledglings.
That's pretty decent.
Yeah, which we were really, really excited about. There was another 2 or 3 groups that we couldn't say for certain because they're so cryptic when they're breeding, but there was sort of, again, there was sort of behavior that was indicative that there was probably some breeding going on. One of those groups were cooperatively breeding, which is pretty interesting. So there was 2 males and a female, all provisioning a clutch of I think 3 fledglings. And there's sort of been quite a few reports of Malleimmuran cooperatively breeding, sort of word of mouth, but nothing really in the literature. So we wrote that up and put it in Australian Field Ornithology, which was, if anyone wants to read more about that, Tom Hunt, one of the guys in the project, took some amazing photos of these fledgling Malleimmurans just sort of in the days after leaving the nest. So that's something interesting to see. That answers your question. Was there any breeding? Yeah, I think we had some breeding in October. Then there was another group that we detected breeding in December. But I guess I can't talk about the Emuran translocation without full disclosure. And that was a really dry summer. The following April, we could only detect a few birds, and then by sort of August, September 2019, so 18 months or 12 months after each cohort, we didn't detect any birds on that bunch of surveys. So even though we had this really optimistic sort of initial period where everything was looking great, we've had trouble getting back onto the birds since sort of April last year, which is a real shame. But you know, you have to take it as it comes, I suppose.
Mm. And is the general feeling around that based on climate, or is it based more on the fact that the birds may have just moved elsewhere? What's the Mallee Emu Wren's general range? Is it a bird which can, you know, spread a fair way, or does it usually just sort of pick its home and stay there?
That's another really good question. So I guess the general wisdom has been that they, especially during the breeding season, they sort of have little territories, sort of like fairy wrens do. They sort of aggregate into slightly larger feeding groups over the non-breeding season. So you'll get those groups of six, even eight birds kind of wandering around together. And like sort of how far they move during that period, we're not 100% sure about. But I guess the thought has always been that they're relatively sedentary with some dispersal movements in good years. But the guy I mentioned earlier, Simon Verdon, has been doing a big population study of Mallee Emu Wren in Victoria. And he's been finding emu wrens in Triodia that's like kind of spatially isolated within Murray Sunset. So it's still, you know, they're still within the park, but the patches of habitat are kind of surrounded by fairly large areas of habitat that we probably wouldn't usually typically associate with Mallee Emu Wren. And it's also quite young in terms of fire age. So that's sort of evidence that they can, at some point in their kind of life history, they can disperse a bit further than maybe we thought.
So for you, where to for your research from here? What are you still trying to find out?
Yep. So I've just about finishing up writing an article about the sort of translocation and the monitoring that went on after that and everything we learned through that process. Sort of hopefully I'll have that finished in the next month or so. I'm also planning on doing that audio recorder experiment in spring that we spoke about earlier, putting out some of those acoustic audio recorders and sort of testing how well they work as a method to monitor emu wrens compared with just regular people. And the genetic study is the other thing I'm working on. So I've got we've got genetic material from 85 Mallee Emu Wren that we caught in Murray Sunset and had a cold kine. We've got another three or four samples from Weiperfeld, and we've got some historic samples were collected about 10 years ago by Sarah Brown, who did her PhD focusing on Mallee Emu Wren and striated grass wren sort of in the late 2000s. So she collected a bunch of DNA samples of that time, including a few from Narkat prior to that population disappearing. And where the aim there is to do a population genetic study and sort of have a look at, you know, looking for signs of inbreeding depression and looking at potential gene flow between the like sort of subpopulations, which I guess is related to your question before about their range and sort of movements. Like that's sort of going to give a bit of insight into whether there is sort of movement between these sort of populations of Mallee Emu Wren that are spread out throughout Murray Sunset and had a cold kine. And I'm particularly interested to see whether there's been any gene flow between those really isolated birds in Weiperfeld and how recent, if we can get to that. Yeah, so they're sort of the things that I'm working on at the moment. That'll probably keep me occupied for at least another year or so, I think. And then post-PhD, I don't know, I'm trying not to worry too much about that at this stage, just enjoying the ride.
Yeah, no, look, that's fascinating. I think it's really interesting learning how these things work from someone who's doing it in the field and on paper. I did have one question that I thought of while we were talking.
Yeah.
How many birds in this case in particular, how many birds did get relocated that was sort of seen as a necessary number to function?
Yeah, that's another really good question. And one that we probably don't 100% know the answer to in terms of how many are required to establish a population. We learned a lot during the last translocation, and then we'll do prior to any future translocations, which are definitely on the cards. we'd do some, I guess, some population modelling based on what we've learned and try and kind of estimate what would be required for a population to persist. In this case, we released 78 birds.
That's a fair number.
Yeah, it is. It was about, at the time, based on the information we had at the sort of the start of the project, there was estimated to be around 8,000 Malleimu wren in the Victorian park. So that represented what we thought of as about 1% of the total population. Simon's been doing some work on population estimates, so we have a bit of a better idea about population now, but yeah.
Yeah. So that's a lot higher number than I would have expected, especially since you have to catch all of those birds. do you have any idea of any, I guess you can't really say long term, but short or medium term impact on the populations where you took them from?
Yeah, that's something you have to be really concerned about in any translocation program. Like what impact you're having of source populations. And it's something that doesn't always sort of find its way into the scientific literature either. In this case, we did a bunch of surveys at the capture sites prior to removing birds. And then we've been doing yearly follow-up surveys to try and have a look at, first of all, how much impact there was at the time, and then how long it takes for population levels to kind of increase the level they were before we removed the birds. So we did the surveys in 2018 at the capture sites, and then last year we went back and surveyed again, and we found that populations density was lower at those sites 12 months after removal. It was also lower at our control sites. So the population seemed to have declined at our control sites as well, which, I mean, I mentioned before that it was a very dry summer the year after that, which is one of those things that you kind of can't plan for too much, but they're really important and can throw a bit of a spanner in the works. But we're going to go out again this year and see what it's looking like. And yeah, hopefully we'll start seeing the signs of recovery and we can sort of start answering that question a little bit better, how much impact we've had.
That sounds very interesting. I'm definitely interested to see how you go with all of that, and maybe in a year or two we can chat again and see what you come up with. Moving away from your PhD, yep. A lot of our listeners will know of Rowan Clark. Yeah. I think he is your supervisor, is that correct?
Yes, he is my supervisor.
So I think probably the question that everybody would like to know is, what is he like to study under? And you can put that out in the public space, that's fine.
Yeah, of course. I get on really well with Rowan. I really like him. I'm sure people who have bumped into him out in the field know that he's a very friendly guy. He's always willing to kind of share his expertise. He is, quite frankly, freakish in the field in terms of his ability to sort of, you know, have already counted like 15 birds when he hasn't even got any of his swag yet. But no one will be surprised by that. And I guess the only other thing that's possibly slightly amusing is that if when he's your supervisor, you just have to accept that sometimes you'll want him to read a draft of something and you'll send him an email and you'll get one of those automatic responses to say that he's finding some rare thing somewhere, or flying in one of those Chinook helicopters to rescue bristle birds or whatever it is. But I guess it's always exciting hearing the stories. But no, I feel very privileged to get to learn from him. And yeah,
and I'm sure there'd be plenty of people who would be happy to take your place and and learn from him. So I just have one last question. Of everywhere that you've been birding throughout Australia, or I assume you have, but throughout Australia, is there anywhere in particular that you would suggest should be on everybody's bucket list to bird?
Oh yeah, well, I mean, I'm definitely not like on the same level as a lot of the other birders out there in terms of places I've been. And
but, well, don't compare yourself to Rowan.
No, well, yeah,
to a normal person.
To a normal person. last year I got up to the NT. That was pretty amazing. I sort of spent a bit of time there when I was younger, like a child. I was born up that way, but I hadn't been up there for a long time, and definitely not since I got into birding. And sort of going through Kakadu and Litchfield and all that, it's not even that far off the beaten track, but I had an amazing time up there. Saw heaps of new birds and some pretty cool birds. But I think for me, the sort of, just obviously with the work I've been doing, there's a patch in Murray Sunset, in sort of the western part of Murray Sunset, where it's just amazing. Like you get everything, all of the mallee birds you can think of, I guess except a whipbird, but all of the Victorian mallee birds you just come across all the time, like the black-eared miners and regents and stuff. And yeah, really special spot. Emu wrens and grass wrens all over the place. Sort of that area around Feeney's campground, I guess.
So, Will, thanks for coming on the show. It's been great to chat, and I've certainly learned a lot. All the best with the rest of your study, and I look forward to catching up with you one day.
Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure. A bit of a new experience for me. I haven't done too many things like this, so I enjoyed myself, and hopefully I didn't make too much of a fool of myself, answered your questions well enough.
No, it's been good. And we'll have you on again in a year or two once you've finished, and we'll see what happened with all these mallee emu wrens.
Great. Thanks a lot, Michael.
So thanks, everyone, for joining in today. And we will see you same time next week. Happy self-isolated birding.